Welcome to the Success with God and Psych podcast, where it's all about a purpose-driven life where God and psychology mix together and guide your way. And now, your host who's funny, informative, and a straight shooter, doing this so you have a better life, Dr. Jessica Kersner.
Hey, 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 you know what I like to say, there's no better day than today for blessings, impact, and purpose. And today we continue with my special guest, Rick Peterson out of Philly. Rick is going to continue talking with us today. And today we're going to hear Rick talk about after he met his biological parents, what happens there, and then beginning the path of fighting drug addiction in this second segment of this. And so, without further ado, we're going to go ahead and begin.
All right. And so we're back with Rick Peterson. And last time Rick shared his story with us, and such a powerful story. We started with Rick when he was about 5 and 6 years old, all the way until when he went through foster care, in the foster system, ended up getting adopted. And when he got adopted, it was not necessarily the best environment. And when in that environment, he started using drugs. You know, he found a person at age 13 that gave him some relief in the storm, as I would like to quote it from what Rick said last time. And at some point, he went from no drive to live and thinking he would be dead by 21, 22, till he had a place, a point in time where he felt he wanted to live. And so in the time that we're in Rick's life, he's still angry, frustrated, hurt. He moved out from the parents that were adopted him and rented a room somewhere else. He dated a girl, his mom, still kind of unhealthy all the way around, did some drugs. And then now we're going to pick up Rick's life where Rick says, okay, at this point, at 18 years old, he found his real parents. And so, Rick, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right.
How are you doing, doctor?
I'm doing good. Doing good. It's been a good day. How about yourself?
It's been a long day. you know, some things went on during the course of the day that I wasn't terribly pleased about. But, you know, that's the day. And my work situation's a little crazy, but it's about to improve. And you know, so I'm on the positive, you know.
Okay. Yes. And, well, I guess we could talk about that work situation when we get to this point in your
life.
I want to hear more about it, but I'll wait so we can do it in order. So let's dive in. So you said,
can I say something real quick?
Yes, sir.
I just like to, you know, thank everybody that has listened and that has, you know, reached out to this particular, I guess, you know, episode thing of your podcast. And, cause I'm really, you know, very, very into helping people. And I hope that, you know, that we get the, you know, the positive results that we need and to help others. And I'm all about it. And it's a great experience for me. I just wanted to put that out there. And I hope that, you know, some people are getting some great help from it.
Yes. And so far we have gotten a lot of listener feedback that this has been really powerful. Some new listeners are chiming in because they really want to hear the rest of your story. And at the end of it, I'm actually going to extend people to email in questions that we will do a follow-up segment for. And even if they want to give statements of how this has impacted them, how you've helped them, or even questions, just to follow up asking your advice, asking for help. And so we're going to do an episode of that, and I'm going to talk about that at the end so we can do a continuation. So
you sure.
Add that piece because it's a valuable, this is a valuable story. It has so much impact
and
so much help. And I want to give people, not just when we finish today, that, okay, you have this and we drop off, like, so they can tell you if this has impacted them, but also then they can ask questions too and you can respond. And so
sure.
We're going to do that. All okay. Right. So 18, you found your real parents. Let's jump in. So tell me more about it.
Yeah. I need to say this too. Sometimes, because this is, you know, a lot of things that have happened over many, many years. And, sometimes I might be a little off chronologically, And I actually gave some thought to something we had talked about before. There was a brief period of time actually before I found, and it's really important, before I found my real parents, where I actually did a brief stint in the military.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, one person that I was actually really close to in my adoptive family was my Uncle Jimmy. He lived out in Muncie, Indiana. You know, he's a teacher. I don't want to say where, you know, put his stuff out there, but he was a teacher at a university, and really great guy, really positive influence on my life, very accepting of me, and would correct me on some definitely not cool behaviors, but in a positive way, in a way that would make someone, regardless of their age, say, hey, you know what, maybe I need to take a look at this, but not feel like they're being, like, chastised, put down, told that they're garbage, you know, which I think he understood was very, very important. He knew, obviously, being married to one of my adopted father's three sisters, that, you know, he knew the family, knew how they were, and knew that they were extremely difficult to deal with just on a regular basis, let alone being a parent. So he was really helpful to me also. Not so much, you know, just like dramatically, but just sort of like behind the scenes and with some helpful advice and sort of in a nurturing way. He's a really great guy. Mm-hmm. But anyway, when I was staying, I hitchhiked from Philadelphia to Muncie, Indiana. And I stayed with my Uncle Jimmy for a little bit. And my cousin was there too, his daughter, and we were really, really tight. We were both actually adopted. She was adopted as well. And so, of course, we had that kind of bond. She was a wild child. I was a wild child. When I was there, though, you know, it turned out not to be a great idea, but Uncle Jimmy was just trying to find some direction for me and a way to get some footing under me. So, without getting into the whole process of why it happened, but it's too lengthy, but, I signed up and I actually got in, to the military. I was stationed at Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
Oh.
Yeah, I flew from Muncie to Dallas and then out to Fort Sill. I actually completed my basic. Did the basic, and back then basic was 12 weeks. I believe it's 8 now, because they're really pushing guys through, which is a shame because they're going out on, you know, not fully trained. But at any rate, I did that and came home to my adoptive parents for a week.
Okay.
They let me stay. It was actually not, I wouldn't say like a positive experience. It just wasn't negative. It was sort of bland and sort of blah. But I think even to them, there was a small spark of, oh, well, at least it's positive. And, you know, I felt like, well, at least they're accepting of it to some degree. Mm-hmm. Although I was not a big fan of having my head shaved. But I went back, and actually when I had gone back to base, you have a week before you get sent out to where you're going to be stationed. And I was supposed to go to Seoul, South Korea. And I was playing a game of pickup football, and I ran a catch a pass and stepped in a rabbit hole and destroyed my knee.
Oh, wow.
So I actually, being a kid and not knowing any better, I signed some papers and they gave me about $8,200, and those papers I signed, though, in the small print, thus they say you always read the small print, was basically all they were ever going to give me. I could never get, you know, medical discharge designation, and I never got another dollar out of it, which I should have, because my left knee was completely, my right knee was completely wrecked, destroyed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it took me, back then you didn't have all the things you have now. So it took me, I'd say, about 10 months to walk right again. So, but anyway, shortly
just
after
like that, you were out of the military.
Just like that. But there was also some other things. I had a big argument with a drill sergeant, and he actually pulled me aside and said, "You really don't want to be here, do you?" And I said, "Not even in the slightest." Mm-hmm. And I will say that I remember the day I left with this big brace on my leg with screws through it and crutches. And but I was happy to have on my jeans and my combat boots and my Black Sabbath t-shirt and be on my way. So, you know, I was just happy to leave. It just wasn't for me. Uh-huh. You know, there's a lot of stuff that comes with the military, too, as far as, you know, there's a lot of like hateful things, and they show you films and, you know, who's supposed to be, quote unquote, the enemy. And it just didn't interest me. So but anyway, when I came home, I shortly thereafter, I was actually the way that I found my parents actually was that I was hanging out with some friends and we were having a few beers and listening to some Black Sabbath. And my friend said, "Hey, why don't you just look in the phone book?" And I did. And the third Richard Peterson I called in the phone book was my father. The third one.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. It was pretty incredible experience. Because I had, you know, it had only been about 5 years, but it was a very intense 5 years of wanting my parents and wanting to know why this happened and wanting to know who I was and where I came from. And even though I knew my parents, so I really wanted to know about me and about them. And I was very, very, very much, at least for me, felt a very close bond to my mom, not my father at all in any way. But I did find out that I had a brother and a sister. My dad had remarried and he had two children, my brother Josh and my sister Desiree.
Oh, wow.
And that was a pretty incredible experience because now I was a big brother. And it was pretty amazing. My father, unfortunately, was very I don't know how to put it, but we met my father was a very, very bad alcoholic. And when I actually met him at a bar out in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And the first thing he asked me was, he heard the people that adopted me were rich. Do I have any money? Mm. Yeah, so that wasn't a real good start. I got pretty angry about it. I, you know, basically, I'm not going to get into all the language I used, but I basically said, "Are you kidding me, man? You got to be kidding me that you just asked me."
My first question.
Yeah, go ahead. Do you have any? You
I was
want
saying
to say
that
something?
Was his first question.
Yeah, that was his first question. But I actually ended up living with my real father, I'd say, for about 6 months. And it actually went, you know, reasonably well. I got a job. He knew some people, so I got a job at a restaurant.
Okay.
You know, busting suds or whatever, you know, teenager job. And I got me and my little brother Josh were really cool. You know, it was a period of time of like getting, you know, to adjusting to a new member of the family for them and a new family for me, really, to think about
it. So when you were there, the emotional experience, how was it in that 6 months?
It was so weird. Yeah, you know, there's a huge gap of time, you know, in 12 years. And, I had become, you know, or was on my way to becoming an adult, however irresponsible and crazy I may have been. But I still was on my way to becoming an adult and, you know, spreading my wings, stretching my arms, feeling myself a little bit more than I probably should at that age. But actually one of the best experiences from it was, even though my brother and I were cool, my sister Desiree and I got extremely close. You know, her and Josh were only a year apart in age. But you know, obviously her and I were drastically you know, different. With my sister, we became really close, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I'd say, I'm just giving a rough guess. I'm not sure. I think it was about a 12 to, yeah, about a 12, maybe a 11-year gap, something like that. And she was really excited to have a big.
Oh.
And, you know, yeah, it was really great. And I was excited to be one. For both of them, but just for some reason, for whatever reason, Desi and I were really tight. And I had, you know, I had the look of, like, my hair had since grown back. And, you know, because it was a little while, starting to grow back. And, you know, I had the trench coat, the boots. And my first tattoo, and you know, I had some, you know, my chains and my crosses and all that cool stuff, and you know, my nails were painted black, and so you know, and my sister was kind of like, she liked rock music, and so to her it was like, wow, that's my big brother looking at me, so neat. And it was a role that I really took on. I loved it, and I, you know, I took her everywhere with me. You know, I even started, like, for a period of time anyway, I hung out with like my wilder friends less, and you know, would take her like to do things I liked. I'd take her to South Street or in Philadelphia, or I'd take her to comic book stores with me or the mall. Just, you know, cool stuff for a little girl to do.
Yeah, so at this point,
And
you're being a role model for her. You were doing
oh
positive
wow,
things.
sleep now. Okay. Can you hear me like
Yes, I
this?
can hear you.
Oh, cool. We're on
But
speaker.
you were being a role model for her, like you were doing positive things for her.
I think I don't know if I'd go as far as say a role model, but I think just someone to bond with and to look up to and to feel, you know, like quote unquote cool with. Like, I think she felt that way, and I wanted her to feel that way. I wanted her to feel good about herself. And she was a little bit more, it was very I don't know, she's just very like, not like, you know, self-centered, but centered to self, you know what I mean? Like very just quiet and kept to self, and yet she had this little wild side too. And I think like when I came around, it sort of gave her permission to let that side out, you know. And I was happy to help her do it.
And so you were
So
18, 19 at this time?
yeah, and 19, and I think she was about 7, I think.
Okay. So she was
About
about
that.
seven, and so her wild things were like what? Just like I'm gonna run through
Just
the
little,
park.
yeah, like, you know, I don't mean wild like that. I mean like the way I was wild. I just mean like for her, you know, she was discovering rock music, and she'd be all jumping around and wild, and you know, liking the music. And with me, she, you know, she didn't like the hard stuff I liked yet, but she, I think she was kind of like, as I found out later too, much later, of course, is, you know, she was later on in her teen years was attracted to girls instead of guys. And I think, you know, that she found that in the way that I was, you know, quote unquote, sort of a rule breaker and did my own thing and had my image and the way I looked and whatever, it sort of gave her an avenue to follow, to be her own self and to discover herself and to be the little girl and you know, a teen girl that she was meant to be. And I loved her for it. And my love for Desi is unending. She is a part of my heart. She's unfortunately no longer with us, but I'll get to that later.
But back then it kind of was like you provided a place for her to belong, kind of like you felt before, where you said you just in your freeness, you gave her that ability to be free, and that you
Yeah,
connected and belonged there.
yeah. I think, and also my dad's second wife, was very, she was just weird and wild. She had a wild side too, and was restrictive in some ways, but then just really out of bounds, wild in others. You know, so I think it just gave Desi a place to feel okay about herself, and to start feeling okay about herself. To say, hey, you know what? I'm okay. I'm me. Like, my brother loves me. You know, like, I loved her just for her. Just, she was fine the way she was.
Well,
She didn't
like you
have to
said
change anything.
last time, you know, it made her feel like she had some value. She could connect to something, and which is important, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially when you're at that age. Super important. You know, I think that so much is put out there about, you know, not that you just want to be recklessly wild and you know, as I had to learn the hard way, but you still want to be okay in your own skin. You want to be, you know, we all want to be, you know, in some ways we, you know, the biggest thing, I think the most major important thing of being a human being is that we all want to connect and we all want to feel loved. Yet society spends so much time separating us. You know, you ever stand outside an apartment building and look, you have all these little blocks that everybody lives in, and you could live in next to somebody for 20 years and have no idea about them, know nothing about them. And, you know, our society is so built on separation, and yeah, it's the way we're wired is to connect and be included. And we all want to be a part of whatever it is that we want to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yes.
And I think with me, Desi found a place where she could be comfortable or learn to be comfortable in her own skin. You know, she's still very young at that point. So, you know, she's not all the way with there with that yet, but she's just sort of feeling like, hey, I'm okay.
Okay. But you guys started at that place. And it was solidified kind of when you stayed there for that 6 months. It was something that lasted through that stay until you any.
And we remained close for a good while until I had some issues in my own life that caused me withdraw from, like, period, you know, drug issues. That had nothing to do with not wanting to hang out with her. It was just the drugs were eating me up.
No. Okay, so you found your birth dad, stayed there, and you got these siblings now, and you and one of your siblings become really, really close. And that's not to say Josh was discounted, but you and Desiree.
Josh and I were so close. I just had a different bond with Desi, that's all.
Yes.
Relationships are one of life's most precious gifts, but one-sided relationships, they suck. You give time, love, advice, but when you truly need someone, you feel alone. How do you turn those one-sided relationships into fulfilling ones for you? Tell them you value them and why. Something such as, I love talking to you because you're honest and caring. State expectations. No one is a mind reader, guys. I would love to talk to you every day, no matter what is going on. Tell them that. Walk it out. Simply be to them who you want in return. Give praise and thanks. It feels good, increases behavior, says, I want more. Drop your pride and ask. Give them the opportunity to be there to help you. Lastly, choose people wisely. Use observation, prayer, and wisdom. No, everyone shouldn't be that close to you. That was your Focus Me Minute. I'm Dr. Jessica Kersen of HealingX.K. Email me at focusmeminute@gmail.com.
I was at it, and I picked up a box, and the bottom of the box was sort of dry rotted, and it fell out. And one of those little black phone books we used to all have, you write your numbers real small in, fell out. And my dad said, hey, let me see that for a minute. And it turned out that it had my mother's brother's phone number in it, and 12 years later, and he had never changed it. So I called, who also, by the way, his name was, he was an Uncle Jimmy, real family, different, same name.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I called him, and I told him who I was, and he absolutely was shocked. He was like, Sharon's son, my sister's son. And I was like, yeah. And, by the way, I throw in here too, there was a really weird experience. I had this friend, John, and, we used to smoke a lot of weed, and he was buying weed from someone, and I had this cousin, Leanne, and you know, she stuck out, she had fire red hair and very pretty. And, you know, obviously my mother's sister's daughter. And Leanne and I, before I was gone, were very close. She loves me to death and would protect me. And I was very small when I was little. And Leanne was a big girl, and she would stick up for me. And and so we were very close. And so my friend John told me, you know, I keep seeing this girl, and she's like you described. And I'm like, dude, like, don't play around like that. And he's like, no, dude, I'm dead serious. And it turned out it was her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Weird, like, sort of domino effect. If, like, I found my dad, then I found my mom, then I found Leanne, it was just like bam, bam, bam. Like, all of a sudden, it just was like a rush of emotions and love and anger and hate and acceptance and not acceptance and weirdness and just strangeness.
So you're talking, like, to your uncle, and he says, oh, yeah, my sister's son, and you're like, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so I told him, I said, listen, you know, could you call my mom? And, well, first I said, do you know where she is? And he said, yeah, yeah. I said, she's alive. And he said, yeah, absolutely. And, so I said, could you call her and see if she wanted to talk to me? Because if she didn't, I didn't want to hear it. I just did not want to hear that from her. I just figured if he told me, I would just push it away. Like all the other emotions, I would just stuff it down, push it away, make it go away. And never happened. he called me back, I'd say roughly in like a minute, and said, "You'll call her right away." And so I called her, and she was beside herself. She was like, "Oh my God, my baby, my son." And the first words out of her mouth was like, "I didn't want to give you away. I love you so much. Please come home." And I did. I came home, and it was, I don't even know how to, I think, you know, adequately describe to you what that was like. My mom and her boyfriend at the time, which is so funny too, because my mom was about 5'4", and her boyfriend was about 6'7", 320.
Oh, wow.
Huge guy.
He was really monstrous. Tall. Yes, he was very tall.
He was also just a big guy. He ran a crane operators union in Philadelphia. And he also had tried out for the Philadelphia Eagles and the Cleveland Browns. So he's a really big guy. And I mean, I shook hands with him in his hands and swallowed mine right up. Couldn't even see it. But anyway, I remember my mom getting out of the car, and the both of us just tears just pouring out, and a whole lot of sorries and I love yous and please come homes and where are you, where do you live, what do you need, are you okay, like just a rush of everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually explained to her what was going on, and so her boyfriend was extremely gracious about everything. I mean, really great. Like, you know, he wanted to have children, and my mother absolutely did not want to have another child. Refused to, wasn't up for discussion, didn't want to do it, felt she had made a terrible mistake and didn't want to repeat it, even think about repeating.
Mm-hmm.
So, discuss repeating it, nothing. You know, for him to accept her son in that way was extremely gracious and kind of him. And, I can say his first name. Danny was a great, great guy. He took good care of my mom. I always respect him for that. And, he actually tried to get me involved in, like, you know, the unions and stuff, but I was so wild. I didn't have any direction. And it takes a lot of discipline to learn those trades. And I don't even drive a car, let alone run a monstrous crane that knocks over buildings. So that wouldn't have been a good idea. It's not for me. But my point being, to tie that up, is that he was just very, very kind about all of it.
Mm-hmm.
He never complained about it. You know, he would give me money to, you know, make sure I had something in my pocket and go out and look for jobs. Or even if I wanted to go to an Ozzy concert or something, he'd give me money for the ticket. Just really nice guy. Really, really nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I stayed with my mom, and actually it's funny, the first real like time we hung out, my mom absolutely had no love lost for my birth father. But for me and for how much it meant to me, she invited him over to the house actually. So it was me, my mom, my dad, and Leanne all hanging out together. And wow. For me, that was huge. It was like, I mean, I literally sat there in front of everybody and didn't give a shit. Like, I just, excuse me, I'm sorry. And cried like a baby. Like, it was such a, like, a weight taken off me. I had wanted it so badly. And I had it. And I will say that the true statement I've ever heard in life is, be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it.
You have this moment.
For that moment.
Uh-huh, go ahead.
For that moment, it was the most incredible experience of my life. You know, incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, don't get me wrong, like, in hindsight and being older, much older now, and knowing why my behaviors were what they were and why people were doing the things they were doing in this big mishmash of two families and people trying to raise me in their way. I had some incredibly positive experiences with my adoptive parents. I mean, I've been to Greece, France, Belgium, Italy, Holland, England. You know, I've experienced other cultures and learned about a lot about the world from them. that I probably wouldn't have. I mean, I would have read about it, but I may not have ever been there. And it also instilled in me the excitement. Although I had it on my own anyway, before I was away from my real parents, the excitement about learning and discovering and whatever subjects I did enjoy, going full tilt and learning everything about it I could. And so I got some positive experiences from them. I saw plays and realized the excitement of live music from them. And, mm-hmm. you know, although it was my music, not their music, but still, you know. So I got a lot of positive things out of that, but just far too much violence, negativity, anger, frustration, just too much.
Yes.
On both sides.
So now when you have your birth mom, you have your biological father, you have Leanne, who's this cousin who is really close to you, and you have all these pieces that, you know, you long for when you're out of place. You know, you're like, if I had this bag, what would it be like? And then you get it back. And so in that moment is surreal. But then, like, having all those pieces back, how was life then? How did it become?
The glow of, you know, my mom letting him come over, that wore off real fast. Because my dad and I would occasionally spend time together, and he usually wanted, because now I was old enough, I could go to a bar and have a drink. And my dad would call me and say, hey, you know, tell your mom that we're going to do this, we're going to do that, but let's go to the bar and check out some girls and have a few drinks. And that's what we would do. I mean, you know, it was my dad, and he was letting me, you know, be sort of what I was already doing anyway, except in an adult, you know, way. However adult you're going to be at 18 or 19, 20, whatever. And, you know, he would let me go to the bar and we'd have drinks and we'd hit on the girls, even though my dad was married. But it was a very miserable marriage too, I'll say that. But, still doesn't excuse, you know, being out messing around with your wife. And, that's something I've never done, by the way, my entire life. I don't cheat on my girl.
Mm-hmm.
But, at any rate, I just never understood the appeal of that. But anyway, you know, I and one part of me, I loved it that me and my dad, I remember my mom one time, she said, you call me in 2 hours and you let me know, Richard, where you and that damn father of yours are at. And, you know, I had to lie about it. And I was like, oh, you know, cause I had actually hurt my knee and my dad was supposed to drive me to the hospital. Cause my mom didn't drive and she didn't have a car. So she got my dad to take me, but we never went. And we went to the bar and started tearing it up. And then when she said, when are you going to be home? I said, oh, I'm just going to crash at dad's. And she was furious because she knew what he did. She knew that he gave me the okay to go to the bar and drink. And, you know, she's not stupid. She could hear the noise in the background, even though we tried to, I don't know, quiet the bar.
But that's good. So your mom was trying to be a mom. Like, actually, at that point, she still
she was
being a mom.
Yeah, she was being a mom. Absolutely. And I think, too, you know, I got to say, in hindsight, my mom and I over the years had some horrifying fights, terrible experiences, really bad, where I really lost control of myself. And she said some god-awful stuff to me that really brought me to tears. And but I got to say that I adore my mom, and she's a fighter and she's tough. And the part of me, which I didn't know, you know, of course, until many years later, I actually am a believer in the fact that, you know, some of the characteristics and the actual, quote unquote, put into action ways that we live, the things that get tested and how we see who we are and, you know, whether it's fight or flight or what we'll do, my ability to stand my ground and take no, you know what, is absolutely in my blood from my mother. I absolutely believe that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to take a break right here, and then we're going to come right back and pick it right back up. Okay?
Sounds like a plan, all right. Doc.
All right. Meet Fred. Fred once felt stuck in a rut, and he had trouble connecting with other people. Then Fred read the book Path to Loving Yourself by Dr. Jessica Kirzner. Fred found the book interesting and exciting. The down-to-earth approach that the book takes helped to increase his self-esteem. Now, Fred spends less time feeling bad, and he grew to first love himself. Eventually, he gained the capacity to connect with others. You too can benefit from The Path to Loving Yourself by Dr. Jessica Kirzner. Get your copy for only $9.95 from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Books A Million. That's Path to Loving Yourself by Dr. Jessica Kirzner. Get up on your signed copy at healingaxcoach.org.
We're back with Rick Peterson, and he's telling us his story. And so to continue where we're at, Rick, you said, okay, so you get y'all your parents around, and then now you're spending time with your father. And I guess you're trying to bond in his own way. And he's taking you out to drink. You know, you guys are going to the bars and hanging out. And then mom's trying to be a mom, you know, and you're staying with her now, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Together. I'm working. Excuse me. I'm eating a cracker.
That's okay.
We're working. I mean, I'm working, you know, just like little construction jobs here and there. And, you know, a lot of ways too, my mom and I are still in that, kind of in recovery, like that pink cloud kind of thing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like everything's great. Love each, even despite the thing with my dad, but basically, you know, we love each other. Everything's great. We found each other. There's no problems. Until, my drug addiction issues start to really rear their head, with hard drugs, Freebase, you know, a lot of Freebase, smoking coke, and actually had sat down with my mother and done a few lines, only on New Year's would they, bust out a line or two, and, however crazy that may sound, but for her, she could just party once and then leave it alone for a whole year. For me, everything had to go. Like, as soon as we started doing it, I have to do everything. Can I have another? Can I have another? Can I have another? Like, real addiction. Like, you know, and it's rearing its head. And when I'm even when I'm drinking, my mother's sitting there going, wow. Like, my mom even said, wow, you're a Peterson. You know? Because I could really belt him back at the age of 19 and 20. Like, I could drink you under the table then. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
I'm sorry. And, you know, the freebasing issue is starting to rear its head badly. Not, you know, in front of them, but, you know, you can tell that I'm going a lot harder, but it's starting to show. And, you know, my physical and, you know, I'm tired a lot. I'm sleeping a lot, staying out, you know, past the hours. And my mom wanted me to come home because we sort of had this like weird, like sort of like, it was like one of those, you know, those carnival rides with the boat where the boat goes way up and the boat goes way up the other way. And it goes way up the other, you know, her parenting and me trying to, you know, sort of be my own guy because I had been raising myself basically forever.
Mm-hmm.
So find that balance. But, like, okay, well, if I want to have my mom, I'm gonna have to listen to some rules. And if she wants to be a mom, she's gonna have to understand that I'm starting to grow up and head towards being a man. And so it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but on the outside, you got the dichotomy too, though, because you got your parents and they're trying to say, okay, grow up the right way. But then on the other side, you got your dad. You're drinking alcohol with. You know, your mom. You're doing some drugs with here, and so. It's still kind of it's kind of like do what I say, not as I do type thing, you know? And
I mean, I don't want to misrepresent. I don't want to minimize the fact that her and I got high a few times, but I also don't want to make it where it was like, it's like me and her were sitting around getting high all the time. It wasn't like that.
No.
It happened a few times and then it didn't happen again. And she wasn't pleased with herself for doing it. And I even felt uncomfortable, like, should I really get messed up with my mom? Like, it's sort of something like I do with my friends. Like, she's not supposed to see this.
I got it.
Like, you know what I mean? So yeah. It was weird. And I think it might have happened.
Experience, though, that I said it still is an experience, though, that when you look back on it, you know, it's just one of those things that it happened and it is still salient. Like you said, you don't want to minimize it. It's not the end all be all either. You want to magnetize it on the other end, but it still is an experience that is a salient one. You know, both of them.
Extremely salient. Yeah,
both of those are huge experiences that, you know, those are huge in your life, and I'll tag on it later. But it still is one of those things that when you have this place, you know, when you as a kid, and I always try to tell people that, you know, because even in my house with my husband, we always say we want to do with our kids and not just say. And you know, when you
you want to do what you tell them you're going to do.
Yes, yeah. But when kids see you, you know, it's not that your kids don't see you make mistakes, but there are certain things that when you do certain things with your kids, it's hard. For just because of the natural place kids are in when they're in their teens or you're a young adult, you know, when you have those experiences, it makes it harder for them to be motivated to take your advice, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
And so that doesn't say that I'm not trying to say they were horrible, but I'm saying those things lead to a place where it's hard for you to have fought yourself extra because you saw.
I agree. It didn't, you know, I remember having arguments with my mother about, my drug use and stuff, and saying, wait a minute, you sat there and you did this with me and you partied when you were younger, and now all of a sudden I'm the bad guy. Like, having those kind of stupid arguments when you don't know what you're talking about and you're not understanding that you're going somewhere completely different with it than she did.
Yeah, but although still,
She had a hand in it, you know, so.
But it still is, it's a valid place, though, because at that point you're like, okay, now everyone's saying I'm bad, but we were doing this at one point together. You know, and like you said,
absolutely,
you couldn't control.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. And so that's huge, though. And I don't want. I mean, I know you don't want to magnetize it, and I'm not trying to make it the end all be all. But I do want to put a pin there to say, you know, at that point, if you were trying to fight yourself, that makes it harder to then take all the, you know, the good instruction they were giving you, because then you unfortunately got to see too much of the negatives. You know, like.
I agree with that. In hindsight, I definitely agree. Yeah.
But anyway, so go ahead. Sorry. I just wanted to put that there for, you know.
No, that's cool. That's fine.
Okay. So you had this stuff with your mom.
You're going to make points.
Yeah.
That's what you do. that's your job. So anyway, there came a time where, you know, it was just time for me to not live with my mom, you know, not because of anything terribly drastic. It was just time for me to to do my own thing. And so I actually ended up, what's that?
How old were you then?
I'd say I was 20, 21, maybe.
Okay, so you stayed with your mom a couple of years.
Yeah. I stayed there for about 2 years.
Okay, good.
Maybe a little bit, you know, or a little bit, two and some change.
Okay.
There came a point where I was really heavily involved with selling of drugs, and I made some bad decisions in that area from a pure business perspective. Regardless of what the business was, I made some bad decisions because, as they say, a monkey can't sell bananas. and I was about to say a banana can't sell monkeys. anyway, so. You know, this monkey was trying to sell bananas, and it really wasn't working out well. I was eating a lot more of the bananas than I was selling.
Uh-huh.
I decided to take something that didn't belong to me in that department from those people. So me and my friend had to get out of Dodge. It was dangerous. We probably made it more in our minds more dangerous and reckless than it actually was. It wasn't like we were dealing with Pablo Escobar. But, you know, we were dealing with some dangerous cats. And so we took off. And on the way to where we were going to sort of hide out, the car broke down. And it broke down in a garage. We broke out some of the party materials with the guys that were fixing the car. And they did the same with what they had. And it was lines of what I thought were cocaine, and they turned out to be heroin.
Oh, wow. So we're going even harder now.
Yeah, you can't get any harder.
Yep.
And so I knew, even with all the drug stuff I was doing, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Hold up. Pump the brakes. Nah, we're not doing this. So I don't even think I recognized how I liked it, because when you first do that drug, you immediately throw up. So if you get past that little point, which lasts about 10 minutes, then the euphoria comes. And when that euphoria comes, oh, does it come. And it is extremely, allow me to take a minute to sidetrack here and say, I have to do this. Like, anybody that has dabbled with opiates has, you know, obviously you heard of this stuff, you know, cross country from coast to coast, that's going on with opiates right now. It's nationwide, and it's tragically comic that they say, oh, this epidemic. It never hasn't been an epidemic. This drug has killed more of my friends and put them in the ground or given them life sentences behind trying to acquire money to do this drug than any. It's been the apex predator in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Has destroyed, it has been the great white shark of my life. It has destroyed everything that it's touched, that I can possibly think of. I overdosed from it 12 times and continue to use. I can't even put it into words. But anyway, I got to a point where I was taking trips from, I ended up in New York. I actually lived in Albany for a while. I'm sort of skipping around, but I ended up in Albany, New York. I got married, actually, because where we hit out was actually on the Cape, Cape Cod, and I married a girl there.
Okay.
I'm not going to go too deep into her life.
That's okay. How long were you married?
We were married. What's that?
How long were you married?
3 years.
Okay.
But I was extremely unfaithful. I got married on my lunch break at work, wearing a Megadeth t-shirt, some combat boots, some ripped up jeans, and a captain's jacket and American Express bow tie that I bought at a dollar store for a dollar. I had no, my mom was against it from the beginning. She thought the girl was absolutely incredible, which she certainly was. Great, great girl. Really tried really hard to make a very young marriage work, and it was a freaking disaster. This is a part of the story. Actually, you know what? I am going to stick to this for 1 second. This is a part of my story where I can honestly say that I'm ashamed of who I was then.
Mm-hmm.
It's one part where my actions were reprehensible. I was ashamed of the man that I was, and rightfully so. I was violent. I was violent with my wife. I was, you know, extremely deep in addiction. Although I wasn't the heroin then, I was really bad with the freebasing, really bad. Like, you know, my paycheck was going to it. I was unfaithful to my wife. I was mean. I was just an awful person. Awful person. The one thing that freebase did to me that heroin didn't is it just made me violent and mean and nasty. It turned me into a fiend. I was a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, except the only guy I was ever around was Mr. Hyde.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had it to the point where my wife was actually scared to be at home. It's not like, no, I wasn't like hitting her and beating her up on a regular basis or something, but there were a few incidences where I slapped her. And I know this is hard for listeners to hear, and they may think, oh, this scumbag. And at that time, I definitely was a scumbag. I was the lowest common denominator. It's important to say that, because where I am now is such a drastic different
mm-hmm.
person. It's like, to me, even though that guy hasn't been out in 30 years, I am always aware of that addiction can take me places that I don't want to go. And I'm not talking about being homeless. I'm talking about, or, you know, being strung out even. I'm just talking about the beast that comes out.
Well, I think it's important because, you know, people, when I have worked with addicts in the past, you know, everyone thinks that in the beginning I have control over it, right? And then at some point, the addiction takes control because it's an addiction and it is running your life and you kind of see what you're doing, but you know, you're not in the place to stop any of that. And so I think it's at that point where your wife, the addiction has now taken over your whole life, your personality, you know, your thoughts, your every day. And so I think it's a fair thing that you can say, okay, now I can look back on and say that person, oh my goodness. And there are things sometimes we make mistakes in our life. It's okay to say that I made that mistake and that was horrible, but that doesn't mean you're a horrible person. You know, you just had a period of life that, that was a bad period of life. And I did some bad things that.
I'm sorry. Come here. My cat is getting, well, my friend's cat that has adopted me is it getting in the way here. Right? cut it out, Motorhead. So anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying that that was huge that, you know, you can say that you can look back on and say, yeah, I was not proud of that person. And that person did some horrible things. But at the same time, that person was the person that was taken over completely by the addiction. Like it had control of your mind, your actions, when you woke up, the time you went to sleep and whether you even woke up or went to sleep, you know, so it's like it's okay. And it's fair to say, you know, those things were horrible. And when I look back on it, that was horrible. But that does not mean you're a horrible person. But at that time, when you say, if I look at me then, I did not like who I was. And I don't want to be back there again. And it serves as a motivation to continue.
I will not be back there again.
Yes.
There's something else that's important too, is that my dad, and I knew this from my mother telling me, and some very like sort of faded memories of my birth father. I knew that my dad had hit my mom, and I kid you not, even in my teens, I always swore, like, whenever I have a girlfriend, I will never ever put my hands on her. It was a big thing for me, even though I had the violence in my life and I had the anger and the whole butchering notes under the pillow and all that stuff. I knew that those were outside experiences that happened to me that made me. And now I didn't think consciously like this, of course, but I just fought that. I knew that wasn't me. I didn't want to be violent. I didn't want to be mean. I didn't want to be angry. I didn't want to be, although I will say I often used anger as power to control others, even my adoptive parents, because they would not raise against me once my anger was out. They would literally go into their bedroom and close the door. But like, I'm trying to think of how to put it. Like the guy that came out at that marriage, I'm just going to use her first initial T, or unless, did I say her name? I don't know if I did. to the letter K, let's say K, the K, and it carried through to two other relationships where I was a really violent guy and scary to be around. And not just for them, just for anybody. My friends, people didn't want to hang out with me because I was explosive and dangerous. You never knew when the violence would come out. I didn't know when it would come out. I was scared sometimes of who that guy was.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important for me to say here, just since we're on the topic and then we can move on to other things. But, you know, the way that I was able to lay that guy to rest was that I knew that whatever came down the road, whatever problems I had with addiction, with life, with jobs, with whatever may come, spiritual things, whatever, I knew that I didn't want to hurt anybody, whether it was with words, physically, mentally, whatever. I had been hurt so many times. And I think the only positive thing that came out of all that negativity and horrible, horrible, dark place is that it made me realize that, you know, I love life and I love people and I love to see people shine. And when you treat someone that way, it's not just hard for them to shine, it's impossible. You're putting their light out. And nobody has the right to put someone else's light out. Mm-hmm. And like, I was making it impossible for Kathy, Vanessa, and Jill I'm just going to say her name. Heck with it. It's impossible, and you can edit if you need to. But that, those three women went through hell with me and didn't deserve it. They were all great girlfriends, although they had some mental health issues of their own, which made what I was doing, like, the, oh, I'll fix them type thing, you know, that whole problem. But I want to say that each one of those women that went through that period with me of the violent guy were fantastic women, great girlfriends, wonderful, talented, creative, interesting, funny, exciting women. And I was very fortunate to have experienced the period of life that I did with each one of them. And they unfortunately were not fortunate to have experienced life with me.
I think it's interesting that you say that, because one thing that you said when you were younger and, you know, you had all these people hurting you, right? You had all these people hurting you and people you were trying to trust and people that, you know, you were in a position that were supposed to be trustworthy. You could lean on them, had done all these things to you. And it wasn't that they were all bad, and we're not saying they were, but you still ended up in a not good position, right? And so you had this place where you were like, okay, the thing that kind of motivated you was that, you know, even though you had no drive to live there, you were like, I'm a fighter. I can fight like all this anger, and I can keep pushing through, and I have to be going through this because I have a purpose. And then you get to a place where you're like, okay, when you met your first girlfriend, and she was essentially the person that gave you that first place of connecting, and then you felt empowered by being able to help her, and gave you those strong characteristics of, okay, I am a person that can help other people, and I'm going through this for something, and it gives you that I am not completely bad, or I'm not completely flawed, right? And then when you get into this situation now, and this addiction has taken over, it's almost like at some point you had to say, who am I? Because when you see that guy, it is the complete opposite of who you knew yourself to be through the whole thing. You're like, okay, wait, you know, I'm now hurting people. I'm now the person that they were supposed to trust as their, you know, their husband or their guy, and I'm hurting them. And it's like, wait, so you have this moment where I have to confront, you had to confront yourself, you know, and say,
absolutely.
Man, you know, I'm now the big bad bear. Like, I am hurting them. I'm this. And okay, I may not have control when that drug takes over, but I can try to gain control over doing that drug so I don't become that person. And that's huge. Like, that is a huge thing to me. Because some people can let that take them down because they say, okay, I made these mistakes. And you don't use it as an empowering place to say, wait. But I was that person that was helping people. Like, I like to see that light in people. And I don't like this place, you know, and I'm not saying that was an overnight thing, because obviously this took a period of time, because addiction is a disease, and it takes till you get to a place where you can see the damage it's doing to you and you can see yourself. But still, when you got to that place, you now saw it and you're like, oh, no. I got to be the person that puts the light in. I can't be the person that's doing this place. And that's great. And so now, how old are you after your third relationship, where you had this, after the third one, for the last one where you say she was in, where you were in still, and when you're, the drug still had taken over, how old were you at this point where now you're saying, okay, I don't like.
Well, let me interject here. That I had taken some trips from when Kathy and I got divorced. I had taken some trips from New York City to Florida, back and forth. Like, and it's really important to say that geographically, I was running all over the place because I was trying on one hand to escape me and leave the bad guy behind. And then on the other hand, I was trying to find me and see where is the good guy? So where is the real me? Where is Rick? Who is this guy? Where the hell is he at? And of course, like, again, I would say this, and I probably don't have to. I don't consciously think of it in that way.
Remember that dream job you had and life got in the way? That business startup and things didn't go so right and the money and people weren't in line? That degree you wanted to finish, but something was always preventing it? That relationship you weren't ready for, that you still regret, you still wonder what would have happened had things been right? Winston Churchill said, "The pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity. The optimist sees opportunity in every difficulty." When you're not finishing these things talking about the negatives, you're the pessimist. When you find that one reason to keep pushing forward, you're the optimist. Be an optimist today. See your opportunities. You only need one reason to keep pushing forward, and that reason is you. You're the best reason for you to keep pushing past the obvious difficulties and still saying, yes, yes, I will do. Walt Disney said the way to get started is to quit talking and begin doing. So begin doing it today with no excuses. I'm Dr. Jessica Kersner with your Helinax, Dr. K's Focus Me Minute. Email me questions or comments at focusmeminute@gmail.com.
When I was down in Florida on one trip, I started dating a girl down there, and she had vast experience with heroin. And I went deep into a heroin addiction, which I started to do actually at the tail end of my relationship with Kathy. And basically, from the time I was, I'd say, 22, 23, to the time of a year ago, I was on heroin.
Mm-hmm. And you're 52 now, right?
No, I'm not 52. I'm 50.
50, sorry, 50. So that was when you were
40, any extra shit.
Sorry, 48 or 49.
Don't tack on any extra shit.
49.
I want to get there, but yeah. Which we'll, you know, get to. I actually was clean for, I had periods of time where, like, I was clean for a year and a half. I was clean for 2 years. I got one where I was almost clean three. So there's periods of time where I was completely heroin free in there.
Mm-hmm.
And not with, you know, methadone or anything like that. And then there's other times where I was on methadone. You know what I mean? I've always searched, been trying to break that. Let me tell you, there's no battle that I have faced that has been more taxing, destructive, and then on the other hand, rewarding when you succeed, than escaping a heroin addiction. It's when you come out on the other end, and there's like, it's like this incredible feeling of like, I'm living now. I'm not just surviving, existing, and like, I'm living and I'm breathing and everything's brighter and colors are better and life is good. Like, even when you don't have nothing, like, you know, in the standard society, oh, I have or I don't have, like. But anyway, when I got involved with this one particular girl, we came back to New York, and I called my mom, my real mom, about 6 months into being back in New York, and she had no idea about the heroin. She didn't know. And I knew that I needed help. And it was the first time I tried to actually stop drugs, period. Like, really wanted to stop. And I called my mom and I said, I'm in trouble. And she was like, what's going on? And I said, I need your help really bad. I need to come home. And she was like, what is going on? I said, she said, are you just like bouncing around? You have no job? And this is exactly how I told her. I said, oh, I have a job. And she said, what's that? And I said, I'm a full-time IV heroin addict.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, what? And I said, yeah, I'm addicted to heroin. And she said, how are you doing it? And I said, I'm shooting up. And she was distraught. And it took her about 20 seconds, and all of a sudden she had the guy I told you about, Danny, that good guy, on the phone with me. And he said, you know, you got to get yourself down here. I don't know how you're going to do it, but get your ass down here and I'll take care of the rest. And that he did. I came back. I'll be honest with you. I ripped off some kids for some money, got some heroin, enough to make sure I wouldn't be sick until they could get me into whatever they were going to get me into. And through his connections and some very, very kind people in unions and stuff like that, they got me into a very, very, very good treatment facility. And I went through my first full heroin withdrawal And back then, they didn't give you methadone or anything. You just had to go cold turkey mm-hmm. in a room. And I literally spent 5 days curled up on a ball, in a ball on the bathroom floor, shaking, shivering, vomiting, in agony, muscles cramped, crying, threatening to leave 1,000 times, begging for just one shot to take the pain away, mm-hmm. to take the madness away. Mm-hmm. It's hands down the most agonizing. I wouldn't wish it on the devil. It's I've never felt anything like it, and I've been through it numerous times. And it's just nothing nice about it. There's no way to, you know, and those people are like, hey, it's just like having the flu. Or I'll tell you what, you give me the flu and I'll give you that and we'll see who comes out on the other end. It's not like having the flu. It's like being dragged through hell.
Mm-hmm.
That you feel like you'll, at the time, you feel like you, and I didn't sleep for almost 72 days.
Wow.
And I don't mean, and I mean like not a minute.
And so how like, old are you? How old are you here?
I was in my 20s.
Okay.
I don't remember exactly what it was. I was in my 20s.
Okay. So your first and I was in your 20s, your first one you had.
Yeah. Like, listen, it's really, really important that, like, you have to understand as we talk this story, heroin is going to weave its head in and out of the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And a lot of decisions that I made or things I didn't do were predicated by that drug. But this isn't really a story about or a life story about addiction. Addiction is just a part of it.
Yes. Yeah.
I think it's really important to note here too that a lot of times, I think you and I discussed before about labels, and I think it's really important that one of the things that has always frustrated me about having the issue of addiction in my life is that, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, you're an addict, oh, you're a junkie, oh, you're this or that. And then we label ourselves that. We hear it so much that we say, oh, that's what I am. Or whatever your issue is, or one's issue is, we start to call ourselves that. And it's really, really important to know that whatever your life problem is, whatever your issue is that that's not who we are. Like the way people say, oh, you're an effing failure. Oh, you're an F up. You're a mess up. No, like, you failed at something. It's a moment. It's not you. It's not who you are. It's not who one is. And it's very, very important to know these things, because once we realize that we can't be labeled, we're unstoppable. You know, once you shed labels and you are able to shed those who would point fingers at you and tell you what you cannot do, there is nothing that you cannot do.
And you say that because you're like, if once you accept that label, it becomes the only thing you are. You feel like it is your totality, and it's not.
Yeah, like, listen, people would tell me, are you effing junkie? And then I really got to a point where I was just like, damn, man, I'm nothing but a junkie. I'll never be anything but a junkie. Like, and that kept me locked up in using for the longest, because, you know, then it goes to a million other dark alleys and avenues that you really have no business in being. Like, listen, the worst neighborhood I ever lived in was inside my head. You know, I've lived in some bad neighborhoods. And none of them were as bad as the one in my head. And even that, you know, listen, everything's about perspective. Everything's about, you know, like we talked before about obstacle and opportunity. It's all about how we see things. You know, our chances are what we make them. You know what I mean? Listen, right now my life is uncomfortable at best, but I had two great friends that actually care about me. My boy's a hardcore dude, but he wouldn't have anything more than to have me succeed. You know, he's a hard ass dude. He busts my chops sometimes, but we're real friends. That's what friends do. Like, mm-hmm. a real friend doesn't let you sit there when you're being mediocre and let you act like you're lit. You know what I mean? Like, you're not lit. You're mediocre, and you could do better. And that's really, at the end of the day, what my boy is trying to do for me.
He's pushing you to be better, pushing
you. Absolutely. And he's had some experiences in his own life that were hard, and he just wants to see me do better. And that there's nothing wrong with that. Like, I don't always agree with his methods, but you know what? At least he's got methods. Like, people that swore they loved me and cared about me and they were my people and my boy or this girl loved me to death, they're nowhere to be found.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But when they need me, I'm there to be found. Turn around, you'll see me standing there going, hey, how can I help? You know what I mean? Which is not Sam and Angel. I always step up and do things when I should. But my heart and my intent and my love for you will never die. And that gets me in a lot of trouble because I put way too much of myself out there when I sometimes need to rein it in a little bit.
Yes.
But recap,
because I think we're going to have to, I know we're going to have to put a pause here and do one more episode where we finish out the rest. But where we
I know this is gonna happen.
I know, but and you know,
it's okay. And I give much of my time and story and effort, and whatever you ask me, I'm willing to do it.
Well, the great thing for me now is okay. So we got this now, where you're in life, and you have, you're now saying, okay, I have a problem, you know, and I have to admit to myself that what I'm doing is not who I want to be. But on the other hand, it's an addiction, you know, like this part of this addiction is also pulling you back into that dark space. Right.
Absolutely.
But then, like you said, there's this other part of you that's like, what am I doing? What's going on here? Who am I? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I get that cross with the labels, because when you start trying to figure out who you are, if you say I'm just an addict because everyone says I'm an addict, then you're like, I have to accept that. And it's not necessarily that, but at the same time, the addiction is a part of what's going on and a big piece at this point.
Sure.
Because it has
right then, it is me. It is me. But it's, you see, here's the thing that's so crazy about that. It is me, but it's not all of me.
No.
And but when it's happening, when you're in it, when you're caught up in it, it feels like it's all of you.
Yes, it feels like it's all of you. And there's a part of you. And for me, I would say that's that God piece, where that light was trying to come into that dark space. Because at this point, I think it was safe to say, like, the world is dark. You know what I mean? Like, you're taken over at this point by this drug habit is now taking, it is now ruling and is having its free reign, right? And there's a light that is still shining that comes in and you say, wait, what am I doing? Wait. And then you start the road to trying to get rid of this addiction. And that starts in your 20s with your first stint in the hospital. And like you said, you've been in and out since then. And we're going to talk about this more next time. And that mentality and that fight and what it takes to just keep pushing, keep pushing.
Can I add one thing before we go?
Go ahead, add it.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you
off. Oh, no, you're good.
And we'll get to this person later. There was a person that came into my life, a girl by the name of Ariana. And I want to say her last name, but there was a girl that came in, Ariana. And we actually dated when I separated from my wife and I was living in Albany, New York. And we continued to date on and off for a period of time when I was in New York City. And she died of a heroin overdose. And at the age of 22, and she had actually gone to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and had a degree in astrophysics, and she was about to go to Rutgers and get a medical degree. And she actually had an incident when she was younger where she got involved in some bad things and had actually burned down her high school gym. That's a whole nother issue. But anyway, that's how I met her, through getting a job where she was doing like community service type stuff. So she didn't have to go to jail. And in her obituary, there was a girl that was spoken to, and she said, Ariana was so naturally smart that she didn't even have to study. She would just walk into a test and write down the answers. And like, that's what it is with addiction. Like, Ariana was so smart. Like, she really was the girl that, and she also modeled. So she was beautiful. She was funny. She was intelligent beyond measure. Stuff that would have our heads spinning, and at least mine. And, you know, it didn't save her. And, like, that's how powerful this thing is. You can't smart your way out of it. You're never going to outthink it. You're never going to box it better. You know, it's like getting into the ring with Mike Tyson's prime. Every time you get in there and you think you're going to beat him, he knocks you clean out. And that's what heroin does. And unfortunately, it knocked her clean out for good. And I just wanted to say that in telling my story and sharing my story with all these wonderful people that are listening and hopefully getting some hope and some knowledge and either and maybe even disliking me from parts of my story, whatever, they're getting something from it, even if it's dislike. And, you know, I want it to be known that I had this in mind from the beginning of telling my story, that I wanted to mention her and say what a wonderful blessing she was from God for me, and how God placed her in my life and was to this day one of the most wonderful, beautiful, amazing people that I've ever come across. And I still carry her love with me to this day. So, you know, I wanted her to not be forgotten.
Okay. And I don't think people will listen to your story and think that they don't like you or that you're a horrible person. I think it's just a real story, and it shows that, you know, life isn't black and white, and it's not even all gray, right? That there's sometimes there's a right and there's a wrong, and then sometimes there's a whole bunch of stuff in the middle. It's all of the above, and the road sometimes to where we need to be is not just as easy as saying, okay, today I choose and tomorrow you're there, right? And that's important because some people think that it is. And then some people don't. They say, okay, I don't expect that, but then they expect it to be a year, you know, or they expect it to just be 2 years. And sometimes it's longer than that. And that doesn't mean that you're not making progress. Yes, and it doesn't mean that you're not making progress, and that doesn't mean that you're not in a different place. But I think that being able to look back and seeing where you came from is how you see how far you've come, right? Sure. Because a lot of people don't look and see where they come from. They try to forget it, right? Like it didn't happen. If I can just forget I was that person or forget I made that mistake. But
and that's a big mistake. Like, listen, I you know, they don't say, I mean, I'm not a big fan of cliches, but they are cliches for a reason because they're true. And but one of the, I feel personally, others may feel differently, but I think one of the biggest mistakes that I've ever made and that others can make from where I stand is to do exactly what you just said. I mean, you really hit the nail on the head with that. I commend you. Is that, oh, I just want it to go away. I just want to forget it. That's, as a matter of fact, that's one of the biggest problems with addiction, because nothing goes away. Nothing has been solved. Things go away when they've been solved. That's when you're done. Mm-hmm. That's when a problem is solved. It goes away because you solved it. There's no problem. So when you don't do any work, you know, it's sort of like prayer and God. And like, you know, a lot of times people, oh, God, you know, I love you. And could you just, and I don't even mean material things or money or whatever, but they're just like, you know, they feel bad for someone or they want something to happen. And they're like, oh, God, if this just happens, blase, blase. And it does, it might happen, but it happens in God's time. It happens in, you know, things, and even just lifetime. Like it happens in lifetime. It doesn't, things don't always happen the way you want them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There are things that I've wanted to happen so bad, and usually they happen, but they happen as they're supposed to happen. Not now. You can make no mistake. You can put enough positive energy into things that you do change the course, but that's a whole nother discussion. Anyway, so you know, I just wanted to put that out there that I really, really agree with you on that. Like. You know, you can't just will things away. You have to do the footwork, you know. God grants us things, but you have to put in the work. He wants to see something. He wants to see some effort from his creations.
Yes. And then looking through what you went through.
And I'm not even a religious person, but that's just something I just know.
Yes.
You know, to me, God's a spiritual issue. I always feel that, and this is just me, but I feel that religion divides us. Spirituality brings us together. And, you know, every war is in the name of this God, that guy, that guy. But when we all just take a minute and we catch our breath and we say, hey, you know what? I don't care what color you are. I don't care how much you weigh. I don't care how much money you have. I just like you for you. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And you're okay just being you, and I'm okay being me. And it seems to work out a lot better.
Yes, it does. And God is about love. And he loves you. Yes, and he loves you when you made the mistakes, and he loves you when he is helping you come out of the mistakes, you know?
Absolutely.
And so it's one of the things.
When you lose it, when you succeed, he's cheering you on.
Yes. And that is the wonderful thing about, you know, about God, is that he says, okay, he sent Jesus to die on the cross so that we all can have grace, and we can all, and the grace means that no matter how good I am, I don't deserve it, right? Because God is saying that you can never be perfect. Like, you can never be good enough. And so the blood I send, the blood of Jesus, makes us all good enough. And so it's like, no matter how flawed you are, to if you think you have no flaws, because all of us have them, but people who think I don't make big mistakes, we all, even in the small or the big mistakes, are not perfect. And that is essentially means we need grace. And
yeah.
And you say, man, if we didn't have that, you know, it's I don't know what we would do. It's kind of like what you said earlier, when the hardest person you had to deal with was yourself. You know, when people can forgive others, but cannot forgive me. And even I hear that when you're talking, you're like, these people are going to think I'm horrible. And to me, it's like, they're not going to think.
No, that's not what I said.
No, you're like, they probably think I'm like, they're probably hating my guts or this. And it's like, they don't. But that's that piece in you that would be in all of us when you're telling your story and you're giving your testimony, that makes you feel vulnerable and raw, that says, you know, have I completely forgiven myself? And I look back on that person, you know, it's like, we can look at it and see that, you know what, you just made some mistakes and you were a broken person and you had a lot of hurt and a lot of trauma and a lot of negative things that happen, and hurt people. And that doesn't mean they do it on purpose, but it happens. And we have all been hurt and hurt people, right? But in this case,
don't get me wrong, there was times where I, like, in that time where I was that violent guy, that crazy guy, and that insane guy, literally, and, like the way you have a functioning alcoholic who goes to work and pays their bills, but they just can't stay out of a bottle, I look at that time, a period of my life, as I was a functioning insane person. Like, I went to work, I gave my girlfriend money to pay the bills, I was responsible, but I was dangerous and violent, and I was crazy in my mind. Like the voices of self-doubt and self-hatred and misery and addiction and loneliness and just despair, just utter dark black despair, ruled my mind. And they were literal true voices, that not like schizophrenic voices, but just the inner voices, but six or seven of them just going like, you're shit, you're nothing, you'll never be anything, shut up, go away, you know, your girlfriend hates you, your job, you're a failure, just, and round, and manic voices, just never stopping. And the only time they would ever shut up was when I had, like, a huge release of anger, or I did drugs to calm the beast. And you know,
and that's the piece I want to really sink into in the next one, is that those voices, because now you're ready to start that path of recovery, right? You're going to start the path to be trying to be free. And that's
starting a path to a lot of things.
Yes. You're ready to start the path. And I'm not saying that I expect, or I even think the listeners expect, that this is going to be like, oh, okay, now we're going to hear, now he never made another mistake, or he never went back. And that's not it. The path is, but that piece on the path is not just how many times we try again. It's a lot of that mental place, like you said, those voices, and quieting those voices. And sometimes it's not that they're necessarily gone. It's just that we interject some positive ones in there that start to sound louder than the ones that are bad, right?
Describe it. They start to sound louder.
Yes, yeah. those positive ones start to sound louder. And I want to really get that to come across next, is because that path to get more light in there than the darkness. And it's not necessarily,
we have a three-parter.
Yes, you know, it's like I want that more light than darkness, because without having to do any labels, you say, okay, I went from a place where the darkness took over to, okay, now we have way more light than we have the darkness. And that to me is all about healing. Healing is just finding a way to have there be more light present than there is dark. And the light, like you said, those voices of positivity are louder than those voices of negativity. And so next time, that's what we're going to talk about. So I want to thank you, Rick, to all the listeners, please.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yes, and thank you. And you guys like, subscribe to the podcast.
Like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe. We're going to have Rick on again next week on next Tuesday to follow up with the third installment of this. And then the fourth one will be questions. And that will probably be coming after Christmas because we have the holiday break. But that'll give everyone time to write in. At this point, if you want to write in for what we have discussed so far with Rick, please email me at healingaskdrk. That is HEALING ACTSDRK at gmail.com. And just attention it in the subject line, say Rick question, Rick testimony, Rick, just whatever. And we will know that is for Rick. And then what we will do is I'm going to start the next episode out actually with some questions that you guys have for the part of his life we've discussed so far, because we've talked about so much, and give Rick a chance to respond to that first, to hear you guys' responses to what you've heard from him so far. And after we do that piece, then we will continue on and hear all about the rest of this journey that Rick is still on. That is very empowering for him and for me. And I know for many listeners that I've heard from so far that, you know, it is very powerful. The testimony, when you can hear someone talk about, I can talk about when I was broken, and I can talk about when I was not, and I can talk about my successes, and I can talk about my failures, and how it wasn't necessarily perfect, but at the same time, it was perfect how it all came out to be where I am now. And that doesn't mean that it's something that you would see on a Hallmark card, but it does sometimes end up being a Lifetime movie. And that's because it's the truth. And so we're listening to Rick's Lifetime movie here. And I am I'm thoroughly thankful, Rick. And I know you have no idea.
As am I. Yeah. I'd like to really quick say, to close out by saying, like, I am grateful to you extremely a lot. It's been really therapeutic for me and very helpful. And to each and every listener that tunes into your podcast and listens, I'm wishing you all the best. And don't be afraid to be you. Be comfortable in your own skin. Step out into the day and face what's coming your way. And you'll find yourself to be stronger, better, and feeling fantastic about yourself.
And I think we're going to end on that because that's a great piece of advice. And so you guys listen to what Rick just said, and we're going to talk next time. See you next week, guys. Have a good day.